drive time it is, 0722380712. Yeah, Bill Gates seems to be the source of all evil, according to a lot of people on the WhatsApp line today. Blame everything on Bill Gates, why not? Finance Minister Tito Mboweni has tabled a supplementary budget to help streamline the effects of COVID-19 economically. Most economies in the world admittedly have been under pressure after countries were forced to undergo nationwide lockdowns. So has the minister lined up the priorities? And will the budget help to stabilize things? Big questions. Online, a senior research fellow at the University of Pretoria, Dr. Jason Misorka.
Thank you so much, Shafiq, for having me today.
And you've had a busy day, haven't you?
It has been a back-to-back, so I did miss out one or two things, but yes, it has been quite busy.
Now, if we look at it, I mean, I think we have to understand that the finance minister was between the classical rock, not one hard place, but several hard places all at the same time. It's a real tough one, wasn't it?
It really is. And in his own words, he did state that, you know, he's in a situation where there's no finance minister in the history of the country, both pre and post democratic era, who has ever been in a situation that he is in now, which is really to report rising deficit. There are several negatives that he mentioned that, you know, economies should not be in under ordinary times. So by and large, I think he's really in a difficult place to try and balance the fiscus, you know, explain to us where he's going to get more money and where that money is going to be spent. It is a very, very tight rope.
However, there has been an emphasis on government in terms of infrastructural development. It's a bit late, but nevertheless, it's there. And he says, finally, honourable members, building a bridge to a post-lockdown future will require, and I think this is what is important, we build high-quality physical bridges, roads, railways, ports, and other infrastructures. An emphasis on that, is that a red herring, or is that what they really have to do?
So what happens in if you look at the history of economic policies across the world, one very good example that is used by most economies as they try and climb out of their debts is the way the European region developed, the way Europe developed after World War II. Remember, they literally had absolutely nothing after the devastation of all their plants and roads and bridges. They had zero. And the then U.S. President Truman, he commissioned or he gave quite some large aid to Europe to develop their infrastructure. And that was the basis. Keep in mind, every time you think about infrastructure, it is really the core of any economy. Countries that do not have sufficient or good or efficient infrastructure, they can try whatever they try, but history tells us that they do not develop if they do not have the backbone of the economy, which really is the infrastructure. And so that model of economic development, which looks at getting out of a crisis through infrastructure development, it is being tested, and it has been successful in various contexts. And not least, as I've said, the European region, which, you know, developed largely out of the so-called Marshall Plan. So that said, I think there are two aspects to the infrastructure spending, and one of it is to improve efficiency of the economy so that you have easy movement of goods and people from one place to another and connectivity. But the more we build our road infrastructure, the more we also integrate ourselves into the global economy much more stronger than before. So, for example, most investors will only fly to Johannesburg, and then from there they have to start connecting. If we have airport infrastructure where they can fly into places like Newcastle, a small town, for example, or other smaller towns, then that it becomes easier for them to see opportunities in the regions that are not necessarily the capitals and so on. So that integration is very critical from that point of view. But secondly, infrastructure development, it is one of the easiest ways of creating employment. It could be short-term employment and so on, but it does create employment quickly. So it's a two-pronged approach from that point of view. We improve the efficiency of the economy, and secondly, we try and deal with the question of unemployment, which, as we know now, we will be looking at approximately 50% of the population unemployed. So in my perspective, it is a good response to the crisis. I think the deeper questions would be, the debt servicing, and there are some indicators that are not looking good. Our GDP to debt ratio is going to shoot up to about 81%, which is really not a very good point. And we are going to be paying huge amount of money to the IMF and everybody else that we have to borrow to fund these infrastructure programs. So the immediate benefits of infrastructure spending are really not there. They are going to be in the medium to the long haul.
But of course, I mean, I think we have to emphasize is that in South Africa, we are not in a unique situation right now, because almost every economy around the world is buckling and bending under the heat of what has happened. And there's a very interesting statement that EWN picked up that the minister made, and I'd like to you to comment on this. And this is very interesting. He says, and this is about electricity, one of these is to shift away from the electricity supply system that was introduced in 1923 when George V, the Queen's grandfather, was the king of what was known as the Union of South Africa. The last few years have shown the inefficiency of this archaic system. Provisional allocations to Eskom were made on the understanding that government's electricity roadmap would be implemented. Progress is slow. The principle of zero-based budgeting is that we must see the demonstrable value for money. Eskom will need to show progress in meeting the milestones as laid down in the roadmap. That's a real in-your-face to Eskom, isn't it?
Indeed. I think, and he's spot on. I've done some studies on Eskom and some of these prestators that were started in 1920s in South Africa. And Eskom was started largely to industrialize South Africa at the time. And it played its role in generating power for mining companies and so forth and so on. And at the same time, creating an Afrikaner middle class, most of them who were hired by both Eskom and your ISCO, you know, some of these prestators. So the point that he made, I think, is very critical, that what happened is that government was essentially, it was and is a prestator, and the idea was that it would be used by government as a tool to industrialize. What we have never moved away from, which most other countries have, is to move to a much more mixed energy program. You know, now we've started talking about it, but it's a little too late when Eskom is already under pressure. Countries such as Germany and others, and it's not just about going green. It's also about sustainability. Are we able to provide a sufficient service to a population that is increasingly wealthy in South Africa? What do we do with the increasing demand? And, just last weekend, we know that there were about three plants that failed, and there were warnings, everybody going up in the air that, you know, we need to slow down on our spending of electricity this weekend, otherwise we're going to have load shedding. That's a permanent problem that will not be solved if we are operating under a one service provider in the country, which is Eskom. We have to move towards a much more meaningful, mixed approach, create entrepreneurs as well who are able to provide alternative sources of energy, from wind energy to turbines to solar energy and so on. That's something that we should have had discussions long time ago rather than now. So that is very accurate, that we are operating under a model that was instituted in the 1920s, and 100 years on, we have not been innovative to change that model.
Absolutely. Now, just to sort of a question of definition, the finance minister has been talking about zero-based budgeting. It's a real sexy term, but what does it mean in real English?
So in his case, remember what we did is that in February, for example, he delivers his annual budget speech, and in October his midterm speech. So each of those budgets are based on a whole range of factors, and the principle here is that they would look at how much money has been left in this particular, let's say, in the health sector, and how much money is left in the education sector, and then we either top that up, or we take some money from some of us who did not spend their money. That's how the government budget essentially works. But under this circumstance now, the assumption is that almost every sector is on the ground. You really have to assume that they have no money whatsoever. What can we do to start building up these sectors? So that really is what he means by a zero budget. It's where you have to assume that there is no residue or savings or anything in the account, and rightly so, because as we said a couple of weeks ago, if you look at the impact of COVID-19, it's not just a health issue. It's affected the education sector. It's affected transport. It's affected the mining sector. Pretty much every sector has been blown completely by COVID-19. So it was necessary to look at where do we start to start building this economy. So that's really what they were doing here, reallocating budget as if we never had a budget in February.
Now, a lot of interesting language was used. Mr. Mboweni cannot be faulted for his use of language and the way that he makes fairly complex things understandable. He talks about the wide gate opening the path to bankruptcy and a sovereign debt crisis. And he refers to Germany in the 1920s, Argentina, Zimbabwe in the 2000s, Greece, Argentina having its ships attached, etc. He says, we firmly reject this wide gate. The narrow gate, on the other hand, opens to a path of prosperity. And he defines it as, the narrow gate is an active approach, a nation that takes active steps to rapidly stabilize debt and grow the economy. By doing this, we will create jobs, reduce the cost of doing business, and build a competitive economy. Quite skillful the way he moves between the gates. But what does he mean by these gates?
So, and there was a contradiction in that, frankly, if you look at that speech. So let me begin by explaining what he means by that. If you have a debt-to-GDP ratio that rises, what this means is that you are simply living beyond your means. If you condense that to an individual, if I am earning 20,000 rand, but my monthly expenditures are 50,000, then I am going off a cliff. Somehow I'm not going to be able to pay my debts. My houses are going to be repossessed. So in the same way, if you now upscale that to a national level, it is where we are saying the amount of money that we are making as a country, for argument's sake, let's say it's 2 trillion, but then the problem is out of that 2 trillion we are making, at the moment now, what he did project by end of the year, 80% of that money that we are making has to go towards servicing debts. And that is not a sustainable way. You are approaching 100%. It means you're living from hand to mouth when you get close to 100%. Now, I need to qualify that, though, and suggest that as much as we are heading towards that point, at the moment now, in February, the projected debt to GDP was about 65%. That means 65% of our GDP per year is supposed to go towards debt repayment and debt servicing. But, of course, because of the revised budget now and the expenditures, we are looking at 80%, 80. So there are countries that are much higher than South Africa. And some developed countries such as Japan, they're sitting at 238% of their, so they're paying more debts and so on. But the catch is not the percentage per se. The catch is what that debt is for. If you take debt for consumption, for example, you're simply borrowing money for the purposes of providing the very basic services like Zimbabwe did, then you get into a situation of bailing out banks and so on. Then you get into a situation where that money is not being spent on a productive activity. And that is what becomes a problem. The World Bank predicted, or there's a study that was done by the World Bank a couple of years ago, and they suggested that if you get close to 100% of your GDP, you need to be very clear that you are spending that loans and money that you're making for productive sectors. And if you stay within that percentage for a longer time, your growth begins to diminish. You start having declining GDP growth. So it is a very tight rock. And again, what he was suggesting here is that we need to be careful that we don't simply borrow and borrow and borrow. But at the same time, what he was saying to us is that we don't want to borrow and borrow and borrow like Greece or the Germans and so on in the 1920s. But He also then goes ahead and says, but we have been looking forward to about 65% of GDP by end of the year. Now we are going to look at about 80%. So there is a bit of contradiction there, but what I suppose gives some level of confidence to that kind of planning is that we are going to spend the bulk of that money on infrastructure and so forth and so on. But again, as we know, if we are going to simply on paper spend on infrastructure and then the money goes into people's pockets, then that is not infrastructure spending. We are still going to have high debts, no productivity, and that will send the economy into a spin.
Dr. Jason Misiorka, as always, a great pleasure to chat to you. I know you've had a long day commenting on the supplementary budget speech. Dr. Jason Misiorka, Senior Research Fellow, University of Pretoria. Thanks for chatting to us. Stay safe.
Thank you so much for having me, Shafiq.
Drive Time 91.